This is Kyone Wolf with important news. A comet is currently hurtling toward Earth, and icy sparks from its I'm sorry, but I'm looking through the glass of the booth, and Patrick has raspberry yogurt on his nose. Okay, I'm gonna get it back. Mama's got it. I got it. Okay. Icy sparks from the deadly comet have struck areas in Egypt and Transylvania, and it turns out that vampires are real. They have so far killed 80,000. I'm really sorry. He tried to wipe the yogurt off his nose, and it got on his hand. Okay, Mama's gonna be all right. Okay. Okay, I think I'm good to go. Okay. To recap, 80,000 dead from vampires and more death and destruction are to come as the comet enters our atmosphere. No, Patrick, you have to go to the bathroom and clean yourself up. I can't do the freaking news. Breaking news. Okay. Anyway, on the nose today is Breaking Character, the same as Breaking Bad. And now he and his Oreo problem are featured tonight on Intervention.
I'm not sure I can even come on the air after that. That was very, 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 very funny. All right, so this is the nose. And I don't think an intro has ever made me laugh as hard as that one. I know it hasn't. All right. So with us, novelist, critic, gourmand Rand Cooper from the Mark Twain House, Jacques Lamar from Trinity College, Professor Irene Papoulos. That's who's on the nose today. You'll be on the nose today, too, if we say something you find interesting. The number is 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. We're not going to do fundraising today during this show, but since it's the last day of the pledge drive, I do want to mention, for those of you who like the show, that we really do have this great new – I brought it in here in the studio for so the nose panelists could see it – this great new Colin McEnroe Show mug with a wonderful illustration by Constanza Segovia and kind of a nice rendering of a logo. And it's a really nice mug, actually.
And a picture of Colin.
Yeah. Yeah,
that is guaranteed to wake you up in the morning.
And there's a radiant halo around your head, in sort of in the fashion of sort of Renaissance renderings of angels.
Exactly. It's very Renaissance.
Or Jesus.
So if you want those, you call 1-800-584-2788. You have to pledge $60 or more. 1-800-584-2788. Or you can get them online at WNPR.org. All right. End of pledge drive stuff. All right. We won't interrupt you anymore. So the first thing we're going to talk about, as the intro suggested, is the whole idea of breaking character. What are you doing over there? Are you, like, doing stretches or something?
No, just stretching, sorry.
It seemed like she was about to topple out of her seat.
She was breaking character.
She was breaking character. So this all kind of got started. David Hagelin on Slate put up this reel of Stephen Colbert in five occasions where he found his own show as funny as everybody else does all the time, and he just started laughing. He couldn't continue. And, of course, he does have a character that he tries to stay in, and it's a sort of pompous, self-pleased right-wing pundit. And he just couldn't do it, and he started laughing. And it got me thinking a lot about the whole issue of breaking character, which comes up in a bunch of different ways. And so, Jacques, one thing you were saying is that you liked this because you find the Colbert show hard to watch anyway. Say why.
Well, I think I might have talked about this before, but I find the news section at the beginning where he's in character, whatnot, funny. I find during the interviews where he's interviewing people in character to be kind of unfair to his guests in a way. And I know that they're all in on the joke, mm-hmm. But I prefer watching The Daily Show and seeing Jon Stewart essentially, be himself. I think he's a great interviewer. Whereas it seems like with Stephen Colbert that the purpose of the interview is to generally kind of upstage the guest.
So you like it when he's not that person. You like it when he's more like us.
When Stephen Colbert is?
Yeah.
I don't know if I've ever even really actually seen Stephen Colbert be Stephen Colbert other than the creation. I used to watch him on the show Strangers with the Candy, but he was a very distinctive character on that as well.
So,
and did you like him? Because he was so fun. I thought he was so funny on that show.
He was, but he was, you know, on, you know, sharing camera time with Amy Sedaris, who is quite conceivably the funniest human being on the face of the earth.
So Irene, what we wound up doing among ourselves is kind of circulating other instances of breaking character, some articles about breaking character. It's actually called, in the world of comedy, corpsing. I did not know. I would never heard that term before. Corpsing is when you laugh during a comedy a sketch.
Your character becomes a corpse?
I guess. I'm not sure why. It's one of those words that doesn't entirely make sense to me. But what was your takeaway from all this? What did you find interesting or not interesting about it?
Well, I unlike Jacques, I love Stephen Colbert completely. I love the character. I love the way he does it in character. And so, but I think part of why I love his character is because I feel like you can always kind of see or kind of be aware that there's another character behind it. And so for him to break character seems even just a little bit charming, you know, because of how you see a little glimpse of the person that you, the character that you already know is there. And I find that interesting. So that's, I have some other thoughts about other ways in which we break character, but I feel like I want to say that about Stephen Colbert first, because I think it's worth noting that there's a certain charm to him laughing, you know, by mistake.
All right, but to broaden it out from Stephen Colbert, I mean, first of all, this is occasionally controversial. At the end of the movie Being There, when the credits are rolling, we see Peter Sellers trying to do a scene that's in the movie, although I guess the version of the scene he's doing is much longer and very different. And apparently, I mean, connecting the dots, it must be that he couldn't do it during the movie because he's laughing so hard. And so instead of seeing Chance the Gardener or Chauncey Gardner or whatever his character is going to be called to you, you see Peter Sellers not being able to do this scene. He just keeps breaking up. Sellers was apparently appalled that they did this, and a lot of other people thought it was very unprofessional too, in the sense Rand, you're the film critic. A lot of people feel credits are part of the movie. So at the end of the movie, you don't show the actor either doing or not being able to do the work. And Sellers actually thought it might have cost him an Oscar that year.
Well, I do recall that, and I'd forgotten about that, and I recall enjoying that. And my recollections about the mysterious pleasure of watching people break characters go back to childhood when I used to watch the Carol Burnett show. And one of the perhaps the most fun moment for me in that show would be when Harvey Korman would begin to lose it. And it was usually because he was watching some superb bit of physical comedy by Tim Conway. For instance, his falling down the stairs in slow motion routine. And Harvey Korman would have a line to say, and his lips would begin to quiver, and he would try to hold it in. And I remember being, as a six-year-old watching this, being fascinated. Now, that was a pre-postmodern era. We live in a time where now the structures underlying artistic creations are very often made clear to us. It's considered to be a standard part of an artistic enterprise right now. But back then, things offstage were kept hidden offstage. I think the timing of Being There sort of positions it partway between the pre-postmodern innocence of, you know, early 1960s and now when we in a standard way expose artifice. But to me, I think there are a couple of important points. One, we all have an instinct for mischievous mayhem, and we appreciate in some ways when things that are scripted and are supposed to go a certain way break down. It also, I'm convinced, exercises certain demons for us if we've ever had a public speaking or performative capacity. You know, there are times when, it falls apart. So to watch it fall apart for seasoned veterans, you know, it's a vicarious kind of therapeutic experience for us as well. So I think there are multiple points that this phenomenon touches.
By the way, if you want to call in about this, do you like it when people break character? Do you find it kind of annoying? First of all, the number to call would be 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. apart from Harvey Korman, who really was famous for that, and I think for the most part kind of beloved for it, the other most famous TV character breaker was Jimmy Fallon on Saturday Night Live, where he repeatedly would crack up during scripts and not skits, excuse me, and not everybody thought it was funny. Actually, Tracy Morgan complained bitterly, said that that Fallon, with his laughing and all that dumb stuff he used to do, that's taking all the attention off of everybody else and putting it on you. Like, look at me, I'm the cute one. And on an episode of The Family Guy, Seth MacFarlane, I guess, sort of took it out on Fallon. He had one of his characters, Peter Griffin, actually beat up Fallon and punch him over and over and say, this is for laughing and looking at the camera during every sketch you've ever been in. Who do you think you are? Carol Burnett? You haven't earned what she's earned. One of the realities is that if people do this all the time, comedy falls apart, right? Mm-hmm. Comedy has to sort of, whatever its pretext is, most of the time it has to stay together. You on stage, the comic person, have to not be laughing. You have to be getting the other people to laugh. You start laughing, you're not doing your job. So there's some kind of ratio that under which it's allowed to happen. And the ratio is a pretty big one, like 99 to 100 or 99 to 1 or something, right?
I agree. I mean, yeah, it's only fun when it's extremely rare. But did Jimmy Fallon do it on purpose, or did he just couldn't control himself?
Well, that was the question. He denies that he did it on purpose. He's actually, in Terry Gross interviews, talked about it and said, no, I mean, just occasionally something would happen that would be so funny that he couldn't control himself. Now, there are instances where it is triggered somewhat intentionally. We now know that when Bill Hader would do this character, Stefan, and Stefan kind of specialized anyway in covering his face with his hands. He was this club-going New York aesthete. And what we now know, the writer of that sketch said that they so enjoyed discomforting Hader in this way that they would change the cue cards. They would give him one script, and just before he walked out on stage with Stefan, they would say something like, well, you should be ready to pronounce, you know, Mario Batali or something, because they would have written a whole new set of jokes. And Hader kind of specialized in covering his face with his hands, and everybody did kind of enjoy that. But, you know, Jacques, the other time that people have to break character these days, and I think it happens more and more, is when people are in theaters, not at Saturday Night Live, but going to an actual theatrical production, mm-hmm. and there are people in audiences doing stupid things with smartphones, often taking pictures. Joe Mangello, who was doing Stanley Kowalski in Streetcar Named Desire at Yale Rep, had to stop the show one night and, staying in character as Stanley, tell somebody to stop taking pictures of him. So, as a theater critic, tell us about this.
I've only experienced it a few times myself where a performer basically broke character to address audience behavior. I remember when I was at Hartford Stage working, we were doing Camino Reel, which was starring Betty Buckley, and it was a student matinee, and kids were yapping in the audience, and she was in the midst of a scene. She just walked over to the edge of the stage and glowered at them until they clammed up and then went back. So she, you know, didn't really break characters, but just broke the action, mm-hmm. and went over there. But I mean, you hear stories about, you know, Broadway actors, especially, you know, when there's someone famous in a show, people are apt to take their cameras out and take video or take photos. And it's difficult because you want to respect, you know, that it's distracting to the actor. Mm-hmm. But when it happens, then it suddenly becomes, potentially distracting for everybody in the auditorium.
Right. I mean, ideally, you don't want the character ever to slip out of character because that breaks the magic of the moment. On the other hand, somebody's already breaking the magic of the moment. Got a few calls coming in here. Let me just grab those. I know you guys have other things to say as well. Here's Matt from Groton. Hi, Matt. Matt, you're on the air. But you're not there. All right. I have to break character. Here's Steve from Torrington. Hi, Steve. You're on the air. But your phone doesn't work. Hi, Steve. No, you're not on the air either. All right. You have something
Want to say. Well, first of all, there are ways of doing this that without totally breaking character that constitute a kind of winking that invites complicity with the audience. So in Seinfeld, there were many, many moments when Jerry one of the other characters would do something, and Jerry would smile in this certain way that suggested that he might be about to completely break character, but he wouldn't. And there was this sort of winking communication going on between him and us, in which he said, you know, this, I think this is really funny. I always appreciated those moments. But I think it's also possible to construe this more broadly and to go outside just, you know, performances in movies and on stage and so on. You know, we all, especially professionally and in professional circumstances, or politicians speaking publicly, we all have roles in effect. And it's often unnerving, shocking, and riveting when someone goes off script, whether it's like a news anchor person who has some sort of personal breakdown, you know, and starts speaking personally during the news, or a teacher, if you ever had when you were a kid, a teacher who suddenly started talking in a very personal way. These shifts in idiom and rhetoric that take people out of their roles and that, you know, break their characters. These end up being some of the most memorable and strange moments that, you know, we experience in our interactions.
Well, you know, and just before we go to Irene about this, Irene is going to have us talking about Robert Redford a little bit later, but one of the great scenes in the movie The Candidate is a scene of what you're describing. It's an actor pretending to break character. If you recall, he's on a TV set, and there's something, I think it's an overhead microphone or something like that, that he finds really funny. And so every time that he's supposed to do whatever he's supposed to do as the political candidate, he just starts laughing. Whatever it is, he can't do it, and he has to give up. And it's a terrific
and
moment.
We have very little tolerance for that. I mean, when Howard Dean had his one moment when he expressed himself in an idiom that people found strange and inappropriate, that was the end. Right. The end of his political career, you know, because he bellowed. He yelped.
What were you going to say?
But we loved talking about him, though. You know, we were fascinated by it. Actually, I was going to say something else, but I'm thinking now about one time I was at an event with a bunch of kids. I was in the audience, and there were kids doing things on stage, young people. And one of them was this girl, and she was very awkward and sort of she wasn't doing a very good job. But and I, for some reason, that reminded me of myself when I was younger or whatever. I could not. I had an uncontrollable bout of laughter. And so I was sitting there in the audience with all these other parents who were very serious, trying to pretend that I didn't think it was hilarious that this girl was messing up. And I was so embarrassed. It was so horrible. But that's, you know, that's what happens. You know, it happens to us. How about you? Did you ever, you know, have you recently had that?
I have had the experience of being on the air, not at this station, but at the one I used to be at. I did have one day where I couldn't stop laughing. And I think what's interesting about this, too, is often the thing that makes you do this. I mean, in the case of Colbert, it's kind of interesting because it really is the material that's making him do it. The jokes are so funny and they're so funny in a certain way that he can't not laugh at them. But usually, I think when people break character and they start laughing, it's because of something that almost nobody else would understand.
Yeah.
You know, it's so hyper-specific. It isn't comedy the way comedy ordinarily works. There's some little curiosity, some peculiarity, some quirk in the material that you're going over that strikes you funny. Nobody else would find it funny. That's what happened to me. I was trying to read a commercial, and something about it struck me as insanely funny. I've had the problem also pre-recording stuff in the studio. There's a certain kind of announcement that I occasionally have to pre-record. And Patrick knows that it's going to take us 35 minutes to do it because I won't be able to not laugh.
Well, and this is the way in which this breaking character, it becomes a metaphor for us in our own lives, because we understand, you know, implicitly that we compose ourselves according to various scripts that are in effect handed to us in our lives, and that keeping that self-composed that way is a precarious undertaking, and it tends to fall apart. Whether, you know, you read that one thing that for whatever quirky reason, given how you're wired, makes you completely lose it. And so, you know, we rely on actors and shows and performances to, you know, cathartically do this for us on our behalf, I think.
We're going to grab a call here from Peter in Norfolk. I know this one's going to get on the air. Hi, Peter. You're on
the
air.
Hi. You mentioned Peter Sellers a little bit earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And in Dr. Strangelove, there's a scene where they're all sitting around a table talking to the Russian ambassador, heads of state, all the joint chiefs and stuff. And Peter Sellers is fighting to control his black-gloved hand. And Peter Bull, who is a wonderful little English character actor, is playing the Russian ambassador. And he starts to break up over Sellers' routine. And they left it in. I mean, I suppose they could have edited it out, but it's there with Peter Bull breaking up over Peter Sellers.
The other reason that we like watching these things, and there are, by the way, entire highlight reels of Saturday Night Live performers, highlight maybe not.
And a whole Wikipedia entry, extensive.
Yeah, and I think one of the other reasons we like it is we know that once you start to laugh, stopping laughing, if you're laughing and you're not supposed to be laughing, stopping laughing is a really, really difficult thing to do. And you just, I mean, Wolfie did it so well in the introduction. That exact phenomenon, being unable to sort of get it back into the tube, is and there's something just intoxicating about it, too. And also, if you're the person laughing, a little bit frustrating. Well, I just want to sort of switch tracks a little bit here. There was a different kind of breaking character that went on this week. It went on in the House of Representatives. It featured a stenographer who, as everything was kind of coming to a close in the House of Representatives, the world was watching this vote ending the nation's debt ceiling crisis. And suddenly, this commotion occurred up at the podium. We can let you hear just a little bit of it right here.
He will not be mocked. He will not be mocked.
Don't touch me.
He will not be mocked. The greatest deception here is this is not one nation under God. It never was. Had it been, it would not have been. No. It would not have been. Constitution would not have been written by Freemasons. They go against God. You cannot serve two masters. You cannot serve two masters.
All right, that's the woman. I think we believe her name is Diane Reedy. She's an official stenographer on the floor of the House. She has said, her husband in particular has said that during the week, for 2 weeks, her sleep had been disturbed. Of course, a lot of people who work at the House of Representatives weren't sleeping all that well. But she said I can't sleep. God's got me in the work. God was preparing her for this vote last night, her husband said, because this was the kind of a culmination of everything. This was the big one. Everybody's there. And Diane didn't know what she was sharing. She didn't know when. She just sensed it in her spirit. He's a former associate pastor of a Christian church in Florida. And their position basically is that the Holy Spirit had been waking her up at night to deliver this message to the House. What that message was is a little bit hard to tell, but it involved Freemasons, which is kind of a trigger word. But Irene, this is a different kind of breaking character. But it was also kind of created a stir. It became kind of a viral thing on the internet, maybe for some of the same reasons.
Well, yeah, and also because we were all kind of feeling that way, I think, about that vote. So the fact that somebody, especially a stenographer who's usually the essence of quietness, you know, you never hear, you always see those people sitting there typing or whatever they're doing, but they're always in their own world and they always almost seem like they're not even paying attention. They're just sort of passively recording. And to think that all this boiled up in her and she just couldn't deal with it is fascinating to us. I mean...
And I think it, yeah, what were you going to say, Jacques?
Well, I think we just like those moments where life goes off script. I mean, whether or not it's a moment where you realize, you know, that a politician doesn't realize that their mic was left on and you, you know, catch things that are kind of, you know, ignore the man behind the curtain, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain kind of thing. Or, you know, like when I went to see the Dave Chappelle show at the Meadows and it started going off the rails and there was something profoundly upsetting about it and something incredibly entertaining and fascinating about it at the same time.
But I think there are some other things going on here, Rand. I mean, one of them obviously is we had this suspicion in general that everybody was about to go off the rails, that everybody connected to this was at some kind of boiling point. What's interesting about this is not one of those things where it appears anyway that subsequently this woman is going to be apologetic or say, I just had a bad moment or something like that. She actually does appear to think that this was an appropriate thing to do, that it was a vital thing for her to do, that the Holy Spirit is communicating through her. There's some interesting questions even about, well, could she come back to work?
Well, I would say two things. First of all, what's sort of suggestively trenchant about this is the notion that any person forced to transcribe in its entirety what has been said in Congress in recent weeks would be driven out of her mind. That's something that I think most Americans will understand sympathetically. But the second thing is that the level and the kind of rhetoric that she uttered is really only about a tick and a half or two ticks off what some politicians are saying. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you just subtract from it the get your hands off me or the voices of other people who are trying to usher her out of the room, I mean, you know, she could be a certain kind of senator filibustering. In a way that's garlanded with religious references, that uses the metaphor of the House divided, a very obviously apt and resounding metaphor. So that struck me that one of the articles that you sent us described this as the fringe beyond the fringe, and I thought that was an apt metaphor for it, because it just seems like only a little bit beyond where we've been already in our politics.
That does change it, too, because when I first heard about it, I liked it in a more pure way, because it just seemed like some woman, some average person whose job it was to be a stenographer, just lost it because she couldn't stand it. But then that whole religious element to it pushes it in a different way. And I love the phrase suggestively trenchant, Rand. That's great.
I will be watching with some interest to see whether she's allowed back at work, especially because she's unlikely to be repentant at all about this. I mean, her position is that this was an important thing to do and a very legitimate thing for her to do, and that she doesn't think she went crazy or lost it. She thinks that she did something that was important to do, and it'll be interesting to see how the House treats that. Hey, we have to move on to other topics. I do want to say that this whole idea of breaking character or starting to laugh in the middle of something serious, or corpsing, as they call it in the world of comedy, is not something we tolerate here at WNPR.
This is where we live. I'm sorry. This usually doesn't happen. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we'll see if it gets better. A new PBS film, Journey of the Universe, invites viewers. Here's what's happening. Oh, my God. Periodically, we have technical issues in the show. And today, nothing's going right. It's ridiculous. Okay. What we're going to do is we're going to first of all tell you what's on tomorrow's show. A new PBS film called Journey of the Universe invites viewers to become travelers on a journey that explores the origins of the universe, the emergence of life, and the rise of humans. We're going to talk to producer Mary Evelyn Tucker about the human connection with the Earth and the cosmos. And we'll talk to a Fairfield University professor who got a grant to study chaos theory, which I think I know something about. Could the gentle flap of a butterfly wing in China cause a public radio program to completely fail in Connecticut? We can find out tomorrow where we live, on air and online. Today, we're trying to talk about sustainable fisheries in the program. We had Bill Leggett from Kingston, Ontario. He's a professor emeritus in the Department of Biology at Queen's University there. Hopefully, we will have him back on the line in just a moment. We now have Eric Schultz, who's an associate professor in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Connecticut. Eric, I pray that you're there.
Good morning, John.
This is fun, isn't it?
I think we're back. All right. So this is The Nose. Irene Papoulas, Jacques Lamar, and Rand Cooper with us. One thing that Irene directed our attention to, and this may say a lot about how she feels about Robert Redford or not, we can't tell. He's got a new movie coming out last Sunday in the New York Times, big feature on him called The Sun-Dried Kid. And it talked about sort of how he sort of felt about himself and what his early life was like. It said that he was popular with girls early, winning a Charleston contest at 13, but other boys grew jealous and vicious. Pretty soon it became a regular thing where guys would pass me when I was with a girl and say, arf, arf, arf. And you could see that the girls were bothered. Finally, one of his friends explained that arf was the anti-Redford Federation. I was so hurt and shocked, he said. From that point in my life, I retreated into a more loner place. I was then forever shy of going out and expressing myself, and I would do it in my art. He also talks about going to Paris after his mother died when he was 18. The girls he met in Paris did not find him attractive. This was 1957. He was mocked for knowing nothing about the Suez Canal and American politics. I got kicked in the teeth by Paris, he said. He later said in the article that he didn't perceive himself as a screen babe. Well, let's get something straight, Mr. Redford replied. I don't see myself as beautiful. I was a kid who was freckle-faced, and they used to call me Hayhead. All right, why is this interesting to you?
I just find that so poignant. Doesn't that change your opinion of Robert Redford a little bit, to know that arf, 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 the anti-Redford Federation? You know, I mean, I never really had much of an opinion. He's a lovely movie star. He's a good actor. You know, he has Sundance and everything. But I never knew these details. And it's for me, his character was broken a little bit, you could say. by the knowledge that he suffered that shame and sort of lack of self-esteem, you know. And so I just thought it's so fascinating to think that someone like him, who seems like such a perfect person with a perfect life, has that inner shame. And then when I started thinking about it, I started, you know, I looked at the picture of him. I'm thinking about the movie that's coming out that I don't know a lot about. But I started to think, wow, it's true that in a way he's carried that, you know, I mean, you might say that makes a man like him more attractive. You know, lots of men can trade on that sort of inner shame and in combination with who they are as a, you know, as a famous sort of sex symbol actor. But it just made me think about how many people, for no good reason at all, carry a sense of shame throughout their lives and can't let themselves be who they really be, all the glory of who they are, or who they have the potential to be, because of those early experiences that won't go away.
I do think that there's usually some kind of primal humiliation. I don't know. I think it obtains pretty much equally for men and women, but there's like some way in which you were devalued at some point in your childhood or early adolescence that does steer your boat quite a bit. I don't know. What's your theory on this, Rand Cooper?
Well, I was watching an interview with Robert Reich the other day in connection with his new film, which is, I think, called Inequality for All. Is that
mm-hmm.
right?
That's right, yeah.
Former labor secretary. And he has emerged as a champion for the poor and for a politics that would address inequality in this country. But I guess I haven't seen the film, but I guess he plays a large role personally in this film. And he was asked about his childhood. Now, one of the identifying characteristics of Robert Reich is that he's about 5'2". Mm-hmm. And he said that he was bullied frequently when he was a kid, and that he sort of expected this given how small he was. He made tactical alliances with a couple of older boys who were 3 or 4 years older, who sort of helped protect him. By the way, one of them, strangely, was Michael Schwerner, who was one of the three freedom riders who was later killed in Mississippi. But in Reich's case, he said, I mean, he drew a direct line between his sense of childhood vulnerability and his lifelong commitment to working on behalf of the more vulnerable in our society. I think you can respond to a primal wound in childhood in any one of a number of ways. It can make you furiously intent upon winning at all costs in order to show them. It can help you actually, perhaps this is the red word, Redford notion. It can help you develop an important element of inwardness and imagination and sensitivity, which is a typical sort of artistic crucible. So it's not surprising that many artists identify some primal wound in childhood as the source of things that were ultimately helpful to them. I mean, it's interesting. Redford has always been a hard figure to get a hold of as an actor mm-hmm. in his roles and as a personality. There's something wintry there's a personal rectitude to him that seems a little wooden and wintry and inaccessible. The writer said, Redford is so much fun to be with. He would never think that.
Jacques?
He'll always be Hubble to me. I just love the way we were. The thing is, he's someone who I haven't really stopped to give any thought to his backstory. So yeah, it is kind of interesting. I mean, oftentimes with celebrity biographies or memoirs, I want to get past the childhood stuff to get to the stuff that I, you know, really kind of the period of their lives that I'm interested in focusing on. And you hear stories like this and you realize that I shouldn't always be in such a rush to get through those memories, because those are obviously the foundation for their artistry or
well, although their I think career. I think it's a question we've actually discussed on this show on other occasions, and you know, artists are often quite eager for you to get past those things. They don't want to be defined by those things, A, because they didn't enjoy being defined by them the first time around, and also they don't necessarily want their art understood that way. You know, if you recall, since you were the one who recruited me to interview Stephen King on stage, when King was on stage, I asked him this question. I said, you know, so many of your books have in them this gifted child, this very, very gifted child who somehow or other is getting a raw deal and who needs protection, who needs some kind of special umbrella of protection that he's not getting. I said, is there any chance that that child over and over again is you? And he clearly didn't really relish that question, and nor did he really answer it, too, because I think people, creative people, and celebrated creative people don't enjoy that question for the most part.
And that's why the early parts of their biographies aren't that interesting, because because often we're not getting the real story about what really happened.
Mm. All right. Well, we have to switch gears once again, and we're going to switch gears to Oreos. This is our fourth topic.
Finally, something I can speak to intelligently.
Right. If you don't want to look like Robert Redford, it's easy enough. We've got Oreos right here in the studio, and Khan College is just a little bit to the south of us. Was very much in the news this week because of an experiment done by student researchers down there. I should emphasize my understanding of this research is it's not so far peer reviewed. It really kind of has quite ascended to this model, but even so, it's creating a lot of stir. And basically what they did, and I'll try to summarize it as best I can, I hope I do it reasonably well, they were looking at Pavlovian rewarding and aversive effects. And what they discovered, what they already knew about rats was that if you put an enticing drug like cocaine in an area, the rats will go there. The rats will go, and they'll have the cocaine, and they'll enjoy themselves very much. And they'll just keep going there instead of to another place, even after there's no cocaine left. They'll go there just because they had such a good time.
Because they hope that maybe they'll get a drop of cocaine.
Yeah, maybe it'll come back someday.
Yeah.
So these student researchers at Khan College thought, I wonder what else works like that. And one of the things that they decided to try was Oreos. Oreos, said one article, are also cheap calories, widely available. They contribute to the obesity epidemic. Would feeding Oreos to the rats in this model have the same conditioning effect as giving them drugs? So they designed an experiment, and in terms of the behavior, yep, or the Oreos did it. The rats trained with Oreos spent just as much time in the Oreo room as opposed to a boring rice cake room, even after there were no Oreos or rice cakes, as did the rats. It's just the same way as the rats who were trained with cocaine and morphine. Then they went a step further. They looked at their brains. We examined the nucleus accumbens, which is the brain's pleasure center. We measured the expression of a protein there called CFOS. So it basically tells whether that brain center is being turned on or not in response to a behavior. They found there was a greater number of neurons that were activated in the brain's pleasure center in animals that were conditioned to Oreos compared to animals that were conditioned to cocaine. In other words, the Oreos were turning on the pleasure center of the brain in the rats even more than the cocaine or the morphine. So, Jacques, this is probably not telling us anything we didn't really know, except that maybe these foods are engineered to make us get sickly addicted to them.
Well, there's that. I mean, for me, I'll do an early endorsement for the peanut butter Oreos. Those are really, really good.
And I didn't even know such things exist. What brave new world.
Yes. Although the candy corn Oreo looked disgusting. Oh. I don't know if that was any good. But I actually went to a taping of The Daily Show in New York, and the guest that day was the author of I'll probably get the order wrong, but Fat Sugar Salt or Sugar Fat Salt, and you know the whole thing is about how food is engineered to basically be addictive. So to me, this isn't not necessarily addictive, but pleasurable in such a way that you want to repeat that pleasurable experience. So I am not unlike a rat when it comes to Oreos.
And, you know, one of the articles that I did send around sort of talked about the fact that food is just generally engineered. One of the scientists said, we make our food very similar to cocaine now. Now we purify our food. Our ancestors ate whole grains. Now we're eating white bread. American Indians ate corn. We eat corn syrup. So whatever it used to be, just in the same sense as the chewing coca leaves used to be the way that you would ingest cocaine. It's a very inefficient way to ingest cocaine. Cocaine is a very efficient way to ingest cocaine. So basically, I mean, I don't know. The parallel still stands. Do you have anything to contribute? You seem like the kind of person who's not addicted to Oreos.
Well, as a matter of fact, I think there's something about Oreos themselves. You know, like I used to be, you know, I used to, when my son was young, I used to buy these packs of organic Oreos. And I'd say, well, they're organic, so it's fine. You know, it's no problem. And then I would notice that, you know, they would disappear. And why were they disappearing? Because I was eating them. My son was not really ever that into sugar, but I found those Oreos, you know, even though I'm not even, I don't eat a lot of sugar myself, but there was something about the Oreo, the creamy inside, the fact that you could sort of choose whether you're going to eat the top first, then eat the creamy inside, you know, or just bite the whole thing, or maybe you'll try it one way on one and a different way on the other. And it reminded me of being in, you know, my childhood, where we always ate Oreos, so it has that nostalgic pleasure value. So there's something for me about, you know, the Oreos themselves, that, and I'm looking at them right now on the table, and I just had one because they're so irresistible.
The question is, will you have only one?
Oreos replicate for me a treasured childhood dessert called Icebox Cookies, and this is a dessert that goes back about 100 years. It's very simple. There are very thin, bittersweet chocolate wafers. I forget what company they were originally made by, but I think Nabisco puts them out now, although they're very, very hard to find. There's only one supermarket in this market that sells them. And you just whip up.
And do tell. Why are you going to be a tease like that?
It's the one at Bishop's Corner.
Big okay. Y? Or Crown? Crown or Big Y?
The Big Y.
Big Y.
And so you just whip up a bunch of whipped cream, and then you stack horizontally in a line these wafers, and then put whipped cream in between them, and then cover the whole thing with whipped cream. When you cut it on the diagonal, it creates a zebra-striped white and black, very beautiful thing, and it's completely addictive. Now, I would have thought that because there's a bitter note in this taste, that Oreos have a slightly aversive taste built into them, I'm surprised that they top the list of cocaine-like junk foods. For me, very clearly, the absolute cocaine-like junk food is and I've said this before, a box of Pringles, a canister of Pringles. We have to keep this stuff out of the house. It's the only prophylactic measure that I understand that will prevent me from completely gluttonizing. And so I just try not to be near these things. I was at a dinner party last night, and they brought out two big trays of brownies. For me, brownies are also like this. And I had like 16 brownies. And I sat there with this feeling, with this, you know, dismal abjection, because I've been trying to eat healthily that for the past several weeks. And it just completely caved in. So there is this way in which emotionally caving in to an explosion of gluttony with these foods really does replicate also emotionally the sort of the drug cycle, whereby, you know, oh, I'm not doing that. And then you fall off the wagon. You have this terrible experience. You feel guilty. I mean, it's
like your body takes you over. You
yeah.
didn't decide to eat that many. It just happened,
right,
the way you describe it.
I've got some messages coming in from the control room. First of all, Wolfie says, I've been trying to eat healthily for the last several minutes. also, the book that Jacques was trying to think of is called Salt, Sugar, Fat by Michael Moss. What else do we need to know? They even investigated the term corpsing. It's unclear where it comes from, but may come from provoking an actor into breaking character by laughing while portraying a corpse. So you're supposed to be lying on stage, and then you start laughing.
Oh, yeah.
And that could be the reason. Yeah. All right. We're going to have to stop there because we have to have time to come back and endorse things and also give you our new plug list.
Keep the nightlight burning in the kitchen, baby. So I can go downstairs and cruise. I got them Oreo cream sandwich, chocolate covered cream filled cookie blues.
I just want to say that Oreos are nothing like crack. Do you know why? Do you know why? Because I'm eating Oreos right now, and don't touch me! Don't touch me! This boardwalk is open to the public, and I can dance here and spank myself if I want to. Creeps. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me. Let go of me! I have a prescription for Oreos! Our intern was Corey Breen, but I killed her because I could tell she was going to take my Oreos. The part of Bill Curry was played by Robert Redford. On Monday's show, the lives of lab rats and mice. Guess what they get to eat a lot of? And now, back to the nose.
It is true that the Oreo experiments at Khan College got us into a whole other conversation about rats and mice in labs and the things that happen there. So we're going to do a rats and mice in labs show on Monday. Meanwhile, it's time for endorsements. Before we do endorsements, I'm trying to compile all the things that are coming up that we sort of plug on this show. I'll let you know really quickly what there is. There's a wonderful event for CARC, which is the Connecticut AIDS Coalition. It's on Saturday. Many of us are involved in it. Jacques the MC. I'm a judge. Irene will be attending. It's a fashion-oriented event. You can learn a lot more about it at ctaidscoalition.org. It's Saturday night, 7 p.m. at New Country Motor Cars on Weston Street. But look on their website. You can see a little bit more about it. It's sort of like a Project Runway knockoff. I'm also going to be, and Irene's going to be, on a transparency. You're moderating the transparency panel. Do you want my quick moderating class? I can give it to you afterwards.
Absolutely.
I do a lot of moderating. But I'll be a panelist with her. This is 7 p.m. A show about panel discussion about transparency in government. 7 p.m. Asylum Hill Congregational Church. Also with us, Dennis Horgan, Rob Simmons, Bill Sebus, talking about FOI laws and stuff
when
like
is that.
That is Tuesday night at Asylum Hill Congregational Church. I'll be interviewing on behalf of Jacques and the Mark Twain House, Penn Jillette, on October 31st at the Mark Twain House. CT Improv's Long Form Showcase, we've got a lot of these, is tonight at 8 p.m. at the studio at Billings Forge. And there's the Hooker Day Parade on Saturday, 2 p.m. at Allen and High Street. Rand usually goes to that with his daughter. Many of us march in it. I don't really know what I'm going to do. All right, those are the plugs. Now the endorsements. You get to go.
All right. Well, my first endorsement is an anti-Oreo because at the farmer's market last week, I got all these peppers, orange peppers, yellow peppers, purple peppers, and I've started eating them like an apple. You know, just pick up a pepper and eat it like an apple. Mm. It's a great snack. People think it's really strange, but I've been saying to people, why is it so strange? What's strange about picking up? And it's a delicious, you know, you eat the entire pepper and it's great and there's good ones. So I endorse that.
All right.
I'll stop
An
there.
Excellent endorsement. What have you got, Jacques?
I'm going to endorse two books that I'm reading right now. I usually am juggling several books at a time because of my housefly-like attention span. I'm reading This Town by Mark Leibovich, which is a really terrific book, really great look at Washington, D.C., and how politicians are in bed with the media. And then also Burial Rites by Hannah Kent. If you're looking for a terrific Icelandic murder mystery.
And who isn't?
Then this is what I would recommend for you, Burial Rites.
What have you got for us, Ray?
Two places. First, just up the road, 45 minutes or so, in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, the Norman Rockwell Museum. I've lived here for years. I've never been there. We were there yesterday. It's a small exhibit, but it gives you a great look at his work. And if, like me, you've always sort of passively thought about him very sentimental American illustrator, this showcases the technical genius of his work. And it's really fascinating. Also, they have his studio there that he worked in. You can see it. Second thing, a restaurant that I'm reviewing for the Times in New Britain. It's called Staropolska. Some of you may know there are four or five Polish restaurants on Broad Street in New Britain. This, in my view, is the best of them. You can start in the bar and drink a shot of bison grass vodka, which I'd never had before. And then of the many things that they do well there, I would order bigos, which is a sauerkraut stew with kielbasa, or they have a bone-in pork, breaded pork cutlet that on top of a potato pancake. It looks like the space shuttle. It's enormous. It's in your whole plate. It's fabulous food. The people are friendly there. Staropolska, New Britain.
If you ask the waiter whether they'll just bring you a pepper that you can just eat like an apple, will they do that?
Absolutely.
Will they oblige that request? All right.
Don't eat for a week, though, before you go.
All right. I've got a few things to endorse. One of them is checking the big list. This is at ctbiglist.com. This is the treasurer's list of all kinds of unclaimed property and things that have just kind of devolved into a general fund. You'd be surprised. Check it online. Just type your name in or type your family name in. It could be that one of your family members, even maybe a family member who, God forbid, has passed on, has some unclaimed stuff that, anyway, just, you know, you'd be surprised what you'll find there.
Did you get anything?
I actually do have something on the list, and my late mother has something on the list. So I will be having some conversations with the office of our fine treasurer, Denise Napier. So that's, once again, ctbiglist.com. That's where you find that. It just came out. The latest big list just came out either yesterday or today. Yesterday, I think. I'm also endorsing the performances of the Somali actors in Captain Phillips. I think it's so easy to kind of overlook this. They are, by the way, I think almost to a man, not trained actors. They were cast. They were Somalis living in America who auditioned for this. There's at least one fabulous bit of what, according to Tom Hanks, is improvisation, where the primary Somali actor boards the boat. One of the things that they did was that Hanks and the Somali actors did not meet at all until they actually started filming the scene where they boarded the boat. He had never met these people before. And this young man, he looks at Hanks and he says, "Look at me." And Hanks is looking at him. And he says, "Look at me." And he goes, "I'm the captain now." And this was not in the script. And Hanks says that when that young man said that, he thought, "Oh, we're going to be fine." Even though these guys aren't actors, they're going to be great. And they really are wonderful.
Yes.
The last thing, you've seen it?
I saw it. Yeah, I agree.
I just think it's so easy to overlook those performances because they're like the ones who are – they're in the way of Tom Hanks's precious freedom. But they are amazing. And they give very layered performances. The last thing – Oreos, Schmarios. This is not going to be, I'm not doing you a service right now. It's not going to make you healthier. But Ben & Jerry's Blueberry Vanilla Graham Greek Frozen Yogurt, it really is crack. It might as well be crack. And if you get it, if you have a life anything like mine, there will be sort of almost sullen battles in your house about who's eaten more of it, who got a bigger portion of it, whether there's any more of it, who's entitled to it, who made the last run to get it. It's that kind of thing. It's so good, it's divisive. It's going to mess up your life pretty much the way drugs do. So anyway, that's the Blueberry Vanilla Graham Greek Frozen Yogurt. Proceed with caution. All right, thanks to Irene. You can bring up Grace and Hugh. And thanks to Irene, thanks to Jock, thanks to Rand. We'll be back on Monday with the mice. All the berry, Woodbury, hitting on New Britain. Vernon, I already said that one. Avon, Farmington. Yeah, 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 yeah. She on the radio. She on the radio. On the radio, baby. You and me talking, laughing down.
I'm Kyone Wolf. Do you know what else you can do with a cream filling of Oreos? You can rub it all over your body as an exfoliating cream and dessert.
Mmm, so good. And smooth.